Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Bill Friedman as we're talking about his work called 30 Illegal Years to the Strip as we talk about Las Vegas. Great, fascinating story. And next hour, Bev Harris joins us as we talk about black box voting. Welcome back to Coast, Bill Friedman with us. We'll get to your calls. Bill, I noticed that when you talk about Ben Siegel, you don't call him Bugsy Siegel. He didn't like that name, did he?
No, it was one of those things that came out of his youth. I couldn't find anyone that knew him, probably in high school. He'd done something goofy. The fact was, and you know, I document it clearly, I interviewed everybody, all of his executives in the last 14 years of his life after Prohibition in Vegas, and the people he worked with in L.A. where he lived as much of the time as he could in Beverly Hills. And he was an extraordinary businessman. I talked to bankers, and they said there was no one more respected in America. If he walked into a bank, remember they were small places back then,
mm-hmm.
and when he'd walk in and the bank manager or owner would hear he was there, they would rush out and shake his hand because they wanted to deal with him. He was known as a real straight shooter. The night he was killed, 5 minutes later, they announced he was killed in Beverly Hills.
That's right.
They announced over the speaker system at the Flamingo that he had been killed. And for 20 minutes, everything stopped and all the employees stood around and cried. He treated everybody well. There was nobody that I met that would say a bad thing about him. In fact, he's the only person, and believe me, I interviewed a lot of people, I couldn't get one person to say a bad thing about him, and that wasn't true of anybody else. And there was a man that had stolen from him for 10 years, and I got two-hour interviews with him about how he did it, why he did it. And I said to him, finally, I said, "Weren't you afraid he'd kill you?" And this man became so angry at me, I thought he was going to throw me out of his office.
Wow.
He said, "How can you be writing a book about Ben Siegel and know that he would never kill anybody over money? He would never hurt anybody over money. That wasn't a possibility."
Huh.
He was totally opposed to that sort of thing.
Yet he was a gangster.
Yeah. Oh,
that's what they do, right?
Yeah. But, and he and his associates, who I write about, those seven guys, all of them, and they admitted some murders, but they were always in self-defense. Someone was coming after them for their territories. They never went after anybody else. But they were gangsters. I mean, there was no one I dealt with that hadn't killed people and wouldn't hesitate for a second if threatened. But otherwise, the guys that came to Vegas, they preached against it. They used to preach to me when I was a young man, "Don't lose your way. This is never the right thing to do." And with the movie, the TV series of Ralph Lamb, the sheriff,
yeah.
The first eight shows, they show a gangland murder in each show. You know, in the history of Nevada, there's never been a casino executive or owner killed gangland style in Nevada. Ever won?
Hmm.
Now, Ben Siegel was killed in Beverly Hills, and there's four others that were killed out of town.
Why do you think he was killed? And I do have to tell you, young Will Wilkerson thinks his grandfather might have had it done. What do you think of that possibility?
I hate to withhold, but the next book will have all the details. It took me years, but I put the case together. And that one I can tell you is not true. Wilkerson and he parted ways, and Wilkerson fled the country because of his gambling. He owed more money than he could pay at the time, but it had nothing to do with Siegel.
Now, was Siegel killed because of what we thought were cost overruns and everything else?
No. That was the first thing I did. Siegel's attorney, and all of a sudden I'm having trouble with the name. What a wonderful man. Loved the guy.
It was in your book. I just saw the name today, too. But
And I'm so sorry. Lou Wiener. Lou Wiener was with him every day he was in Nevada. And, you know, it was a small town, so every day they talk, even on weekends.
Sure.
And first of all, the cost overruns weren't bad business. The problem was it was after the Second World War. And during the Second World War, the infrastructure had not been upgraded at all. And all of a sudden, there was a huge economic boom because all of these soldiers were coming home and they had nothing to spend their money on while they were out in the battlefields. And there was all this cash flow. And so America was building. And Vegas was a tiny town and nobody wanted to bother dealing with Vegas. And so he had to pay high prices to get what he needed. And so there was nothing about him taking it. And I was with Lou Wiener, and Lou Wiener, something had happened. And Lou Wiener was the one that thought his partners had done it. And when I questioned Lou, I had many, many interviews with him, marvelous guy, an attorney, and the only man I knew that was both a great business and criminal attorney. And when I put together the evidence that absolutely without question the partners didn't do it, I brought it to Lou, and of course I was afraid popping his position, I might he might get angry with me, but he had no ego, nicest guy, and when I got done, he said, "You're right, Bill, I was wrong, the partners didn't do it." And I said, "But here's my problem, Lou, I've eliminated a handful of people. I don't know who did it." And Lou said to me, "Bill," he said, "this was an unusual murder." He said, and this reminds me of the Nixon thing, you know, to follow the money. He said to me, "Bill, study that, the modus operandi."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "You're going to find that there's only one person in this country who used that modus operandi." It took me years and years and years. Now, many years later, after I put the thing together, I get an interview with Jimmy Blue Eyes, and Jimmy was both the best friend of Charlie Luciano and also Meyer Lansky, and he and Meyer Lansky partnered in casinos just outside of Miami.
Well, and Meyer loved Bugsy Siegel, didn't he?
Oh yeah, those two. They were when I met Jimmy, I started off with, "I understand you're friends with these people," and he said to me, "I was Charlie Luciano's best friend, and after Ben Siegel, I was Meyer Lansky's best friend and lifelong partner." And so I got with him and I said, "I've solved the murder." And he sat there, and this guy had the most powerful stare I've ever seen. I felt like a wonderful man, but I felt like he was looking in my brain. I would not have wanted to been lying to this guy. I never saw an expression. He just focused. And as I talked and he had this there, I thought, "Oh my God, he's going to get mad at me. I'm going to lose the rest of my interview." And when I got done, he said, "Bill, you're absolutely right. But what it took you years to figure out, we had to figure out in days." He said, "When he was killed, we had no idea it was coming. I and Ben and Meyer had to find out, because if it was a personal thing, it was none of our business. If it was a beginning of an assault against our group,
then it was.
Then we had to retaliate and stop it." And he said, "In days we figured it out." But he said, "You did a good job, but there's one piece of evidence you don't have," and he threw that on top of it, and that's the way I will write it. You know that
did it
coup de grace.
He gave it to you. Did it surprise you?
Yes. Not who did it. We agreed who did it, but it's the other evidence surprised me. I had no way of getting it. If they hadn't found it, I wouldn't have that piece.
Well, let me ask you this, though, because I know you won't tell me who did it yet. Was it against them, or just was it against Bugsy?
Whatever it was, they reacted appropriately. I need to get into something like
that. Come on, Friedman, tell me.
I'll tell you what. You will get the first copy of the book, and we'll do it on your show first.
Okay, you will announce on my show first who killed Ben Siegel.
And give all the evidence.
Okay, you got a deal. Let's take some calls. You ready? Eric in Indiana, let's get you going. Eric, go ahead.
George.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, this is Eric, the mind control guy. How's everybody doing tonight?
Everybody's good.
Excellent. Hey, the question I had was, my ex-late stepfather, back in the 60s, was an entertainer in Vegas. And he told me years ago when I was a kid growing up that he used to live across from the street from a mobster by the name of Benny Binion. And I didn't hear that particular name come up, and I didn't know if your guest had ever interviewed Mr. Binion or anybody associated with him or anything like that. Because my stepfather told me some very interesting stories about Mr. Binion, and one of them that he was a hell of a generous fellow.
Well, there was a casino called Binion's, wasn't there, Ben? Bill?
Yeah, there still is, although the family sold it decades ago, yes. The caller is 100% right. The two most notorious gangsters to ever settle in Vegas were Mo Dalitz, who I mentioned, and Benny Binion. The reason why I don't mention Benny is twofold. One, he was downtown, not the Strip. But the big reason was where these other guys were in major gangs, Benny Binion was the toughest individualist I ever met in my life. He had no gang. He stood up to everybody as a one-man show. So he wasn't part of the other things going on. He was part of the industry, and I'll get into his being a nice guy. But he had, for decades, a suite in a Dallas hotel with one crap game. And all the wealth of Dallas that gambled showed up at that crap game. And then he came to town and built Binion's. And he helped, and again, he never once told me about helping anyone. In fact, back to this thing that they didn't want to, the word out, I once said, you know, you're really a very generous guy. And he said to me, no, I'm not. I just want people's money, so I'm nice to them.
Huh. And, hey, he died in 89, too.
Old people who, you know, they didn't have any money at all, and he was taking care of them. And with me, I knew, when I got the course, casino management, I knew an awful lot. All the subjects I was going to teach in my book, Casino Management, you know, which went out of print after 25 years, I knew everything but the accounting. And I knew nothing about how the accounting was. I mean, I knew the documents I signed as a dealer, but I didn't know what went on. So I went to Benny, and I told him it was a Thursday. I said, I have 1 month till I start teaching. I got the course, and I said, I don't know anything about accounting. Can your accountant show me the basics? He says, show up Monday at 8 a.m. Showed up Monday at 8 a.m. He was there. His son, Jack, who's still alive, was there. His casino manager was there. His credit manager was there. And his accountant, Leo Lewis, was there. From 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, they sat there with me. Unless a phone call came in, they had to take. They never left me, and they went over everything in their system, and I said to them, now, are there variations that you've seen? They first told me what they knew about other places. Then Benny started calling the accounting department at every major casino in town, and no matter who answered, and remember, they kept this very secret because they didn't want anyone to know how to break their systems. So nobody ever talked to anybody about how to do it. But Benny was such a nice guy, so helpful. Everyone helped him. And all of a sudden, he was from a small town in Texas, had a second grade education, and was a brilliant man. I listened. When he talked, I listened. And he called him up, and all of a sudden, he'd get real slow. And he'd call up, and didn't matter who answered, he said, I need some advice. Need to know how your system works different from ours. And the people talked to him for a half hour to 3 hours, and he sat there and very slowly said, now let me make sure I'm right. And he'd repeat it, and I wrote as fast as I could. And I walked out of there after 40 hours, and I knew every system there was. And I've never heard of anyone in business. doing this. They didn't want to employ me. I wasn't a family member. I didn't date one of the daughters. They just did that to help the university and to help a young kid.
It's amazing. Truly amazing. And didn't Binion head up part of the Dallas mob?
No, he dealt with them, but he wasn't part of it.
He was not.
All he was in gambling. He didn't even get involved in Prohibition. He just stayed with his gaming table.
Well, he was one of the younger group. He died in 1989, so he lasted a long time.
Oh, yeah. And, I had lunch with him every 6 weeks for many years, and he would have four other men there. Once in a while, they were from the industry, but most of the time, they were the movers and shakers of Nevada, and everybody would share what was going on.
Huh.
So from noon to two, they'd sit and talk. I never once opened my mouth because they're talking about what's really happening.
Were you taking notes or what?
And he exposed me to all the people that were in the news and let me take my own opinion of them.
When you were doing your interviews, did you record people or just take longhand notes?
I wouldn't have dreamt of it. They were so goosey that they at least had culpable deniability to say, I never said it.
He misquoted me, something like that.
They could. I don't think there was a chance. They were real nervous with me, but I very slowly got in. Then after time, then everybody trusted me because nothing they ever told me I ever repeated until I wrote, that they're all gone.
Let's go to College Station, Texas. Ken's turn. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thanks, George and Bill. Fascinating show.
Bill,
I want to know about the old Stardust. I've been going there before they tore it down for sports gambling. When did that start getting popular to all the strips, and how did that get involved for them to make money on that?
One of the old classic places, wasn't it?
Yep. Sports gambling was key. Nevada was the only state to legalize horse racing and sports gambling. They did it in 1941. That's what brought Ben Siegel to town. He got involved in that, and that's what interested him in Vegas. And then he got fascinated with the casinos afterwards. So that was around, but they had to be an independent, separate from casinos. That was part of the original law. In 76, they passed a law that casinos could put in race and sports books. And by the way, in the 40s and 50s and 30s, there was hardly no sports betting in America. Forget how huge it is today. I'm telling you, it almost didn't exist. Horse racing was the king of sports.
That was it.
There were hundreds of bookies doing only horses compared to someone who would do sports. And then the sports took off. So in 76, they legalized. I had the Castaways. I took it over in March. And for the football season, I put the first sports book in a strip casino. And then the Stardust followed me. They were the big operation. They had a huge race and sports, or I should say sports book there. They had a huge one. But mine, we called the hole in the wall because it was literally a closet. It was about 6 feet deep and about 15 feet wide was the opening.
Hold on for a sec, Bill. We're at the break, but we'll come right back. And welcome back to Coast. Bill Friedman with us. Bill, we were talking about the Stardust. It was imploded back in 2007, and it's going to be, they say, in 2018, a Chinese resort hotel. Did you hear that?
Yes, it's being built by a group that runs very fine casinos in Asia. But I don't know anything about what they're doing now. It was the Stardust was the largest sports book in town. The irony was I had a little place, the little hole in the wall, but I had people could park very close and run in. So we didn't have any sitting area. Yet we actually did more business than the Stardust because people were running in and out all day long.
Just betting coming out. It's almost like fast food.
Exactly. And we were hoping, not only were we getting that business, but someone would stop at the tables. but the radio stations and newspapers of the country carried our sports line. I had a my sports manager was Sonny Reisner, and we put up the first odds every day at 9 a.m., which would be noon on the East Coast, with games starting at 1 o'clock. And then everybody else put theirs up. And we had a situation at our place where about 35 men would stand there. And, of course, every game there's a numbering order so that you don't talk about what the teams are. You just have the team number from one to whatever. And as we'd write it up on our boards, everything was handwritten. It wasn't electronic. These 35 guys would all be marking it, and then they'd run to phones and call these numbers across. And I didn't know any of them, but it was clear we were also the official line for the organized crime syndicate's books. They're illegal books. And we couldn't stop people from doing this, but we had pay phones back then, no cell phones. And so I put out word that I thought the FBI was tapping those phones, so at least it wasn't occurring on our property.
That's right. Smart.
And I'm glad I did, because 6 months later, the FBI busted one of the independent books on the Strip because they were taking bets from across the country at a payphone outside.
Before there was Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., the rest of the Rat Pack, and Elvis, who was or who were the top entertainers in Vegas?
The greatest entertainer of that era, and it's likely that none of your listeners will even know his name, because I don't think 5% of America knew it, is a man by the name of Joey Lewis, a comedian.
And he was
a
singer,
too. I have a whole chapter devoted in my book to entertainment of the era, his whole life story. He was the greatest. I was fortunate enough. I saw him when I was 12 and 14. My parents took me to Vegas. Every other star appeared 3 weeks, unless for some reason it would be 2 weeks or 4 weeks. He appeared in Vegas 6 months a year. He was the biggest draw of high rollers, the biggest draw. And I saw him in 54 and was 12 years old. And, of course, I'd seen all the great comedians on TV. Some of them had their own variety shows, and the rest all appeared on these variety shows. And I walked out of there, and I knew I'd seen the world's greatest entertainer. And what is amazing, that was the way he was viewed by the nightclub crowds, the casino showroom crowds, both legal and illegal, and all the entertainers respected him. Every town he went into, every week he had a roast or a toast of himself, and all the money went to charity. More money was raised for charity in his name than any other man.
He slashed up, Bill, by the mob?
He was a singer-comic, and he was Jewish, but he sang with an Irish voice, the great Irish hits. Don't ask me how that happened. And he was at one club, and what we know is the nightclub started in speakeasies in Prohibition, where they put entertainment in speakeasies. And he was at one speakeasy owned by Machine Gun Jake McGurn. He got more money from another place, and McGurn said, don't go, and he went, and they cut his face up horribly, cut his throat. His voice was gone as a singer. He couldn't have any expressions. He wanted to be a comic. The only thing he lived for was to make people happy and make them laugh. He thought that was his goal, his duty in life. And but he had no facial expressions, and my book describes the next 14 years in which he'd get a job and then there'd be nothing, and he just barely survived. And his agent said, this is your last shot. You either make it here or you're going nowhere. He did a Broadway show, and it started at 8 at night, and of course, with his bad voice, having to yell out to the back of the room was very hard. And then he did the midnight show at the Copacabana, and that was owned by Frank Costello, and it had nothing but chorus line kind of
now,
stuff.
Now, is this pre-Vegas or after Vegas?
Oh, pre-Vegas. This is like 40, 41.
Okay.
Siegel brought him in. He did all of you. When I mentioned Adonis and Siegel and Meyer Lansky, they all booked Joey. I mean, he was the man.
He was the guy. 1957, Sinatra did a movie called The Joker's Wild, playing his part.
But it was the exact opposite, because he played it bitter, and this was the sweetest, most lovable, had humility beyond belief. It was tragic to anyone that knew him, because it was the exact opposite.
Even when he was cut up, he was still a good guy.
Yeah, he was a sweetheart. So they brought him in, and so one night, the reviews on the show are horrible. And they go in, at the end of the show, they said, "We're canceling the show." And he hadn't been drawing at the Copa because they'd never had entertainment before. It was just a chorus line and, you know, novelty act.
Mm-hmm.
And he went in that night, and he told his close friends that as he stood in the wings at the Copa, he thought he was going to set a record of being canceled in a Broadway show and being fired at a nightclub. And he walked out there that night. And he just stood and tried to understand what he was seeing, because every seat was occupied, and something that never happened in American nightclubs, he had standing room only on the two side walls and back walls, shoulder to shoulder, were people standing there with their drinks for an hour waiting for him to come on. And he tried to figure out what was going on and what had happened. He so needed both shows to survive on that when all the critics in New York panned this show terribly, he hadn't realized that they'd all gone gaga over his performance. And that night he was the number one entertainer in New York City. Well, they booked him immediately, three shows a night for 3 weeks. They renewed it four times for a total of 12 weeks. At that point, he was the highest paid entertainer in America. He held that position for the next 20 years. He was on the road after that. But Frank Costello had a very elegant casino in Saratoga Springs that was open only for the summer months. And that's, of course, where they had one of the Triple Crown races at the track there.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd bring his whole crew from the Copa up there, entertainment and dinner, up to the casino. And the Copa became the number one nightclub in America. Whoever had the biggest recording hits, whoever had the biggest movie, whoever had the biggest scandal, the only time Eddie Fisher ever played it was when he went with Elizabeth Taylor, because they knew, I don't know if they were hiring him, but they knew she'd be in the front row every night, and the place was a mob scene. And they had whoever was biggest every year, but every September for the next 26 years, everybody who loved New York nightlife knew that he would be opening up for the new winter season.
That's a great
and
story.
He was the only star that played it consistently, and all the entertainers called it the house that Joey built.
Scott in San Francisco. Go ahead, Scott.
Hello, George. Hi.
Hi.
This is Scott from San Francisco. Hello, Bill. I just listened to your conversation. You know, I had a question about Sam Giancana. I think that's his last name.
Giancana? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he, do you know about him? He was a mobster?
Oh, yes.
Okay, and he was friends with Frank Sinatra. He owned the Cal Neva Lodge in Lake Tahoe. And
friends with John Kennedy, too, the president.
Exactly. And I was reading about this when you guys were talking, so I can get a little bit of more info on it. I was wondering if he was the one affiliated with the mass murders in Lake Tahoe back in the 1960s, where they found a lot of bodies in the lake. And also Marilyn Monroe, this is what I was just reading before I called, she spent her last night alive in 1962 at Frank Sinatra's lodge with mafia boss Sam Giancana, according to his source, and that was her hairstylist, George Masters, I think. He died in 1998, and he kind of kept it secret for many years. And, you know, there was some affiliation between Ted Kennedy and the mobster. And I didn't know what her affiliation was.
Yeah, he's in your book, Bill, quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Sam Giancana, you know, he headed the Chicago gang for many years. My interest in him was what he did in Nevada, and he was a hidden interest in Sinatra's Cal Neva. And Sinatra ultimately lost his license. Sinatra also owned 9% of the Sands, and that went at the same time. But Giancana, Chicago, what I didn't get into, my book focuses on those three gangs and those people. It also has the whole history of the Chicago mob, and it has, for the first time, who the first six leaders were. Everyone knew their names of the key guys, but no one knew who was leading. One was a murder, one was a suicide, and the other four were negotiated settlements, and I explained for the first time why they made those moves. And because from the beginning, when I started this, I explained these were the oddest guys to become the most powerful men in the underworld because they stood for everything different, including no violence. And yet Al Capone, who was the most murderous of all of them, and in Brooklyn, Albert Anastasia, who was the most psychopathic, and they had the number two and three largest mafia gangs in America. They absolutely loved all seven of these guys, just loved them. So from the beginning, Anastasia never got involved in Nevada. From the beginning, Giancana, in a small way, he was friends with and in a small way was in Nevada. But when the Stardust opened in 58, he was a major hidden influence owner with Mo Dalitz because Mo came from Cleveland and he was importing all this fine liquor and a lot of it he was shipping to Chicago. So he was very close to them. So Giancana plays a very important role in the development of Nevada, but all in the background.
Was Mo highlighted in the movie Casino? Because there was a Mo Green. Was that his part?
You know, I don't remember the specifics of the movie, but that would be very possible.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it all depends because the Casino era in the movie was long after he sold the Stardust.
Okay.
So I'm not saying no, I just truly don't remember because it would all depend what was going on at the time.
And the last,
you know, if I saw it, I'd tell you immediately. It could have been, but I just don't know.
The last major casino, old casino, the Riviera, just shut down, and that's going to be imploded too.
Yep. And the Tropicana is still there, and that was built by Frank Costello again. He was the man behind that one.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good. We're talking about all the people who live near you, Joe.
Yeah, Bill, you know, I had an uncle that ran a successful club in Chicago. You were just mentioning Chicago. And Al Capone wanted to buy in. My uncle wouldn't deal with Capone, and he had some of his men, Capone had some of his men kill my uncle over that. Wow. Now, I wanted to know, Capone had a lot of influence in Chicago. Did he also have any influence on the Strip in Vegas?
Not Capone, because the Strip didn't exist. He went to prison like around 1930. And gambling wasn't even legalized in Nevada till 31.
Okay. So
Capone didn't, but the Chicago gang was in from the time that Siegel came in a small way. In other words, until the Stardust in 58, they were in a small way, but that friendship was always there. Chicago helped finance the Flamingo, but I never got any sense that they had a hidden interest in it, but they did help finance it.
Yep, they sure did. Anybody from Detroit part of that? Any Detroit mobsters?
The only place that I can think of them off the top of my head is because, you know, we're jumping way ahead, and I researched all this, but I haven't thought about it for years, was the Aladdin, and it could have been in the frontier. I'm not, off the top of my head, I can't remember, well, what cities they were from, but they weren't part of any.
Well, they were from St. Louis. The Aladdin folks were from St. Louis.
Okay. But
I knew them.
Then it could have been the frontier was where I knew them from.
Amazing. It truly is. Bill, where can people get the book, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip?
It's on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, some stores. The ebook is on all retailers, or ebook retailers. It's with all of them. It's $19.99 in print, and as you say, it is huge. It's very entertaining reading for a very long time, and it's $9.99 as an ebook. And my website is Bill Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, .com. I'm sorry, BillFriedmanAuthor.com. I have a blog where I keep up with my activities, and I've just started tweeting, and I'm going to start on Facebook, and you can get that from the website.
You keep in touch, and don't forget your promise.
Oh, absolutely. I loved it. I thank you, and that I can't wait for.
Okay, I'm putting you on hold, Bill. Tom wants to talk with you. I will be back in a moment with Bev Harris as we talk about electronic voting. Oh, boy.